Welcome to the Press On Podcast. In this episode, we'll hear from Kate Curtis on Christadelphian Perspectives on Evolution.
The summer before I left for college, I had a recurring nightmare of being turned into a monster. It was a zombie, most often. In my dream, I was chased down by the undead through the halls of some building, a nondescript store, my old school, my ecclesial hall. I would run and run, but eventually I would get caught and bitten. I would die in the dream, but I wouldn't wake up. Instead, I would chase down others and devour them myself. Eventually, the horror of it would wake me. It wasn't always a zombie. I remember being turned into a werewolf at least once, but the pattern was the same. I couldn't figure out why I kept dreaming of turning into something from a horror movie. I didn't have the nerve to watch or read anything that frightening. Eventually, I mentioned the dreams to my mother. She looked at me, rather pointedly, and asked if I was perhaps going to a new place, where I would be exposed to something that could change what I believed, something that really scared me. It was obvious to me as soon as she said it. My monster dreams were really about the challenge to my faith I expected in my biology degree, evolution. I knew all about the dangers of learning about evolution, of course. While it was rarely, if ever, preached about directly, I recall evolution mentioned in the same breath as other evils of the modern world: materialism, immorality, atheism, evolution. I remember an evening Bible lesson on the ways in which biology proved that evolution was impossible, and an extensive discussion in youth group on how the flood had created dinosaur fossils. I certainly liked that explanation better than one proposed by a different speaker, who suggested the dinosaur fossils were created intact by God, possibly because he thought it was funny to see what humans thought of them. The homeschool science curriculum my family used had a chapter on the subject, which relayed how all the evidence for evolution was ambiguous at best, and fraudulent at worst. As I expressed a growing interest in animal biology, I was provided other resources which were even clearer. Not only was evolution biologically impossible, it went against everything the Bible taught. If you did not believe in a literal six-day creation, your faith was foundationless. With all this information stored away, was it any wonder I was having nightmares? The nightmares went away once I actually started attending college, or at least were replaced by dreams of essays that changed when I looked away and exams that were written in gibberish. I attended classes on evolution, of course, and I learned the material well enough to pass any exam. I could recount the tree of life and the points at which various groups of animals diverged, the transitional forms between clades, even a few potential genetic mechanisms of evolution. And despite all this knowledge, my belief in a literal six-day creation which took place 6,000 years ago never wavered. I went through school with my metaphorical hands clamped over my ears, careful to learn without actually considering any of the evidence. I didn't want to lose my faith. Thinking back, I'm rather ashamed of my younger self, as a follower of God and as a prospective scientist. As a scientist, I was cherry-picking data to support my predetermined conclusions instead of following where the facts led. As a follower of God, I was allowing myself to be driven by fear instead of faith. I wasn't just afraid that my faith would be damaged if I started to believe in evolution. There was also the matter of my church community. I had never heard a Christadelphian argue in favor of any creation narrative other than Young Earth Creation, or YEC. 6 literal days, 6,000 years ago, pure miraculous power with no scientific mechanism. I had no reason to expect that my questions would be welcome. At best, they would be seen as a sign of doubt. The last thing I needed was well-meaning brothers and sisters trying to impress the truth of their convictions on me. I already knew what they believed, or at least I thought I did. I needed to figure out what I believed. More than that, I needed to figure out why I believed it so strongly. I do not intend to discuss my beliefs on creation and evolution in this article. Suffice to say that I believe the issue requires extensive, nuanced consideration. Instead, I want to explain how I became so frightened of the issue. When did young Earth creationism become the next best thing to a first principle? in the end, I would find my answers, not millions of years ago, nor even 6,000, but in the last few centuries. Unlike Christianity as a whole, Christadelphia was born after the development of at least some of the historical sciences. Elpis Israel, published in 1849, may be considered the first truly Christadelphian writing. Darwin's On the Origin of Species, which proposed a mechanism for evolution through natural selection, would not be published for another decade. However, geological theories extending the age of the Earth past the traditional biblical timeline of 6,000 years had been proposed for centuries before Thomas, for example, by Sir Isaac Newton, who proposed a timeline of 50,000 years. Had I considered the subject in detail, I would have expected Thomas to thoroughly refute this timeline in favor of a 6,000-year-old Earth. Instead, Thomas wrote that the duration of the Earth's revolutions around the Sun previous to the first day is not revelated, but the evidences produced by the strata of our globe show that the period was long continued. In other words, while Thomas believed in a literal six-day creation, he also believed in an older Earth which pre-existed this creation, and even suggested that our planet was inhabited by a race of beings anterior to the formation of man, drawn from the angels that sinned of 2 Peter 2 verse 4. This old Earth creation theory explained the existence of rocks and fossils, which appear to predate the biblical timeline, while retaining a six-day re-creation as recounted in Genesis. After Thomas, some form of old Earth creationism remained predominant in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Gap theory, suggesting a gap between Genesis 1 verse 1 and Genesis 1 verse 2, during which rock layers developed, after which a reordering of the cosmos occurred, seems to have been the most popular opinion in the early 1900s. It remained popular through the 1940s, at least, as a means of reconciling ancient rocks with a more recent six-day creation. Opinions on the development of life are more mixed. Authors in the 1800s generally refute any form of evolution. All species of plant and animal were created distinct and unchanging. On the other hand, some later writers allowed for the pre-existence of some form of life, either flora alone, or flora and lesser fauna, or even a pre-Adamic race, as preferred by Brother Thomas. These theories often included an explicitly 6,000-year-old recreation, before which the old creation was destroyed, meaning that fossilized plants and animals might resemble modern creatures, but were not actually related to them. Still others allowed for a continuous creation, some evolution of plants or animals, and an Earth which exceeded 6,000 years in age. While all these views differ in their specifics, I could find no serious ecclesial conflicts resulting from those differences until the 1960s. The apparent tolerance of Christadelphia for varying views on the age of the Earth was not universal. In 1966, a brother, Ralph Lovelock of Watford, was disfellowshipped from his former ecclesia for preaching theistic evolution. Lovelock argued that Adam arose from man-like creatures, distinguished only from modern-day humanity by their lack of knowledge of God, and that the precise mechanism of his, Adam's, creation was unclear. This theory was declared incompatible with the Bible by Lovelock's ecclesia, on the grounds that all humans must be directly descended from Adam, as per 1 Corinthians 15, verse 22. The whole controversy was reported in the Australian magazine and Christadelphian publisher Logos from 1966 through 1968. Lovelock reportedly had been preaching his views openly for some time and had been granted space in the Christadelphian, on whose editorial board he served, at least at the start of the controversy, to reply to criticism. Logos fiercely criticized the Christadelphian's handling of the matter, with editorials flying, advocating for a public rebuke and disfellowshipping of Lovelock. Clearly, the matter was capable of causing great division among brothers. As for the issue itself, five articles were allotted to the discussion of Lovelock's theories and their scriptural refutation. Logos argued for a strictly literal interpretation of early Genesis. 6 days, 6,000 years ago, no gaps or earlier creations. In the opening of the next year's issue, this precise interpretation of Genesis 1 was considered one of the basic principles, a fundamental. Figurative readings of Genesis 1 were equated with the 3rd century under Origen, when human learning was allowed to spoil the plain truth. In other words, with Trinitarianism. Here was the origin of my nightmares. Since the Lovelock debacle, Christadelphia has remained split in its views on evolution and creation. Most authors appear to fall into one of three camps: literalists, old earth creationists, and theistic evolutionists. Literal belief in a 6-day, 6,000-year-old creation is common, and while it is doubtless the oldest and plainest reading of Genesis 1 and 2, the dogmatic priority with which the belief is regularly held seems to descend directly from Logos publications. Several booklets in the 1980s and 90s were printed for outreach by Logos, which addressed the subject. All are vehement in the importance of a literal creation and denounce the wicked effects of belief in evolution in no uncertain terms. Ron Abel's Wrested Scriptures includes several sections arguing against evolutionary theory, an ancient earth, and any non-Adamite humans. Abel's scientific arguments not only echo but specifically cite Logos' 1966 articles on the subject. Abel also proposes a new potential explanation, one which disposes of science altogether. God created the planet with the appearance of age, so any scientific study extending beyond 6,000 years into the past will have illusory results. In the interest of transparency, I will note that this is one view with which I hold a deep and personal discomfort. In the current day, several ecclesial websites specifically assert their belief in a recent creation, and several other sites have been made by Christadelphian individuals to combat any non-literal readings of Genesis. While these websites are not so clearly cited as the aforementioned written works, the theological and scientific arguments made are very much in the vein of Logos. In addition to their belief in a recent creation, all these authors are united in the priority they place on this belief. Evolution is repeatedly denounced in the strongest terms, and any non-literal reading, when acknowledged as possible, is a slippery slope to atheism. Old Earth creationism is probably the next most commonly held position in the literature, and it may be defined by its variation. All Old Earth creationists hold to some extremely old creation of the universe and to an extremely recent creation of man, but the details of scientific and scriptural justification vary from author to author. For example, Harry Whitaker's 1988 book Letters to George and Jenny, a book of miscellaneous advice for teens, is willing to allow a prehistoric race of man, but cannot accept the scientifically proposed age of that race. Adam and Eve are placed at less than 10,000 years ago. Like Logos, Whitaker suggests that errors in carbon-14 dating are the result of some massive catastrophe, though his event of choice is not the Genesis flood, but a pre-creation event wiping out historic man. Alan Hayward's God's Truth, an early Christadelphian apologetics text, rejects both a young earth and the recreation theory, instead claiming the 6 days of creation as either 6 days of God's scale, and those are very different from the days we know, or the days in which God revealed the story of creation to one of his inspired historians. Alan Fowler's A Drama of Creation agrees with Hayward's refutation of recreation, but prefers to treat the Genesis account as a drama, in the style also suggested for Job or Song of Solomon. It should be noted that while Fowler's theory allows for a more complex and ancient fossil record, it is not arguing for theistic evolution, but for creation over an extensive period of time. Fowler places Adam between 4,000 and 5,000 years ago, a unique creation by God, with antecedent cave people described as lacking his unique characteristics. John Bolello's Bible and Science, Design versus Chance lists 7 different potential views on the timeline of creation, ranging from a recent and literal creation to theistic evolution, and considers the middle five, all forms of old earth creationism, to have roughly equal scientific and theological merit, and all of these to be fully acceptable for fellowship. Theistic evolution is rejected for its lack of scriptural merit. The strict literal view is technically accepted, but Bilello warns that it dismisses the scientific evidence discovered since Newton and Galileo, and notes the dangers of raising it to a first principle, as often occurs. While gap theory and other forms of old earth creationism are fairly common in the literature, true theistic evolution has only recently been adopted by a handful of Christadelphians. This belief may be distinguished by its explicit acceptance of Adam as having evolved from pre-human hominids instead of being created ex nihilo by God, and more generally accepting transitions between groups of animals instead of variation within groups alone. These positions are not held publicly by particular ecclesias, but instead by individuals. Perhaps due to the recency of its acceptance, or the still controversial nature of the theory, this belief is also not espoused in any print media or Christadelphian journals, to my knowledge. It should be noted, for those interested in investigating the matter in more detail, that many Christadelphians prefer the term evolutionary creationism to theistic evolution. Advocates of theistic evolution tend to consider the gap theorists to be misunderstanding the science. However, I have found none who would hold their scientific perspective as a principle of fellowship. Admittedly, these authors, and some of the gap theorists, do vehemently rebuke the young earth creationist community for its dogmatism and perceived lack of scientific rigor. And while I have not seen any arguing for disfellowship, I will not claim with certainty that no such view exists. Contrast this with the literalists, who do not allow for any interpretation of scripture or science save their own. So, the question stands, where and when did this dogmatism develop? Where did Logos get its arguments? I believe the fourth of Logos's 1966 articles is the key to tracing the history of dogmatic, literalist creationism. In addition to the fossil evidence and the layering of geologic strata, this is the first Christadelphian article I have found to address the matter of carbon dating. I shall dispense with the specifics of the science for now. Suffice to say, Logos argues that since the current scientific methods rely on steady, consistent processes, they are invalidated by the Genesis flood. Logos postulates a water barrier in the atmosphere, Genesis 1 verse 6's waters above, sometimes referred to by literalists as the firmament, which would result in drastically different pre-flood conditions, as well as the incredible forces unleashed by a global deluge. Other arguments are made, the scarcity of fossil evidence, the non-linear nature of strata, and the deceitfulness of evolutionists. All of these objections echoed the lessons I had learned as a child, in church and outside of it. For its arguments, Logos has one main citation, Whitcomb and Morris's 1961 book, The Genesis Flood. This book does not primarily address six-day creation, but focuses its attention on the titular flood's explanatory power over the geologic record. Whitcomb and Morris propose nearly all the same arguments as Logos, and more still with which I was familiar, radioisotope dating being invalidated by pre-flood conditions, including a firmament of water vapor, creation with the appearance of age, the modification of animals after the fall to allow for carnivory, before which all animals were vegetarian. Above all else, the Genesis flood contends that no intermediate theory between creation and evolution can exist. According to the culminating argument of the text, evolution must have its source in the pride and selfishness of man, and ultimately in the pride and deception of the great adversary, Satan himself. And evolution's whole character is squarely opposed to that of biblical Christianity. If the Genesis flood was the source of Logos's scientific arguments, Perhaps it was also the source of its vehement insistence on a young Earth as a first principle. The Genesis Flood is not a Christadelphian publication. While I was unable to determine the specific denomination of either of its authors, they were certainly part of the mainstream American evangelical tradition. Nor is the book's influence confined to Christadelphia. On the contrary, the Genesis Flood is considered to be the founding text of the modern young Earth creationist movement. This is not to say that mainstream Christianity and evolution had never clashed before, see Davis for a good overview, but Morris and Whitcomb's work was undoubtedly the most recent spark. It may be noteworthy, then, that Logos was not the only Christadelphian publication to cite the Genesis Flood. The book was reportedly reviewed quite positively in the Christadelphian, the same magazine that Logos feuded with over its willingness to print the writings of a theistic evolutionist not even a decade later. In fact, the Genesis Flood itself was apparently available through the office of the Christadelphian by 1971. In addition to his writings, Morris founded the Institute for Creation Research, which in turn inspired the founder of Answers in Genesis, Ken Ham. Both these sources have continued to cross-pollinate with Christadelphia. I can personally recall Answers in Genesis materials being shown in my youth group, albeit with the warning that some of the theology included would be Trinitarian. I was not given any such warning about their scientific or theological interpretation of Genesis being questionable. And while I cannot speak for any ecclesia save my own, I suspect I was not the only young Christadelphian who was generally steered away from non-Christadelphian sources, but was encouraged to study Answers in Genesis's creation science material. What then can we learn from this exploration of Christadelphian history? First, that there is no orthodox position in Christadelphia on the mechanism of creation. Perhaps this is unsurprising to many of my readers, but I would have been stunned to hear it, even 5 years ago. Second, Christadelphia is not so separated from mainstream Christian influences as we like to believe. We often like to think of ourselves as separate, not only from the world, but from Christianity as a whole. And by and large, we do hold ourselves apart. However, we must not fool ourselves into thinking we are utterly free from influence. Lastly, and perhaps most importantly in my mind, we can stand to be a little less sure of ourselves. Let us listen to perspectives with which we disagree, preferably without calling each other grievous wolves prophesied of in the end times. And before we claim to have the weight of history on our side, let us take the time to make sure we are not merely projecting our own perspectives back into the past.
Thanks for joining us on the Press On podcast. You've been listening to Kate Curtis. For more, you can visit pressonjournal.org.